Welcome to episode 10 of Alternate Realities, the podcast series where we literally look at alternate realities, different perspectives on life. My guest today is the lovely Jackie Smith, and I'm so privileged to have an interview with her. Her story is amazing. It tells the story of a woman who was the first Red Devil, the first woman to wear a maroon beret, although she, by her own admission, did not do P Company. But it's nevertheless an amazing story of inspiration to not just women, to men also. It shows how setting a goal, having something in your mind, can start off as something quite small and lead to the most amazing career, and how important it is to follow your dreams. I hope you're going to enjoy listening to Jackie's story today. A very warm welcome today to my guest, Jackie Smith, who's got an incredible story, and I'm so excited to be having this conversation today. So, hi, Jackie.
Hello, Jo. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And you?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you. Surviving, keeping sane and safe.
I think that's the thing we're all trying to achieve at the moment, isn't it? Right, so let's start, Jackie, with the beginning of your journey. I believe that you left home when you were 17 to join the WRAC.
Yeah, it was before I was 17, actually. I went to the recruiting office in Middlesbrough, and my ambition was to be a physical training instructor in the army because I was absolutely sports mad. And I did all of the paperwork and the medical and everything before I was 17. And then I actually joined the army on, I think it was the 3rd or 4th of April, 1969. And I just turned 17, yeah. It's 50 years tomorrow, actually, since I did my first parachute jump.
Incredible. So you've joined up, you've kind of decided you want to join up and you wanted to become a PTI. Where and when and how did it happen that you came to join the Red Devils?
Well, after basic training, I went to Guildford, where it was the WRAC depot. You know, you learn to march and salute and learn all about military procedures and everything. Before you go to the PT school, you have to go into a trade for a year. You had to. I don't know what it's like now. And so I went into the Royal Signals, and I was too young to be, after signals training, I was too young to be posted abroad. You had to be 17 and 10 months. And all the girls that were on the signals course with me were older than 17 and 10 months, and they were getting all these exotic postings, you know, like Singapore was still open, Hong Kong, lots of places in Germany, Malaya. And then they got to my name, Smith. You know, I was quite a way down the line, and they said, Aldershot, well, I wanted to go abroad. You know, I wanted to go to one of these exotic places, but
not very exotic, Aldershot, is it?
Well, I'd been to Aldershot during my basic training at Guildford, and went into the Naffy Club, you know, the roundabout club, and it was the most incredible evening of my life. I'll never forget it. You know, there was junior parachute regiment blokes and depot para blokes doing all sorts of dances well, you'll understand because you've been attached to the parachute regiment.
I think I might have seen a few of those dances, Jackie.
Well, there's a dance of the flaming I won't swear on here.
Yeah. I think I've seen a few of them. So I can imagine that was an incredible night for you.
Well, we were just glad to get back to Guildford safely. We ran from the roundabout club after seeing the jukebox being thrown out the window, and there was fights everywhere in the roundabout club. You know, it was all this testosterone and attitude and everything. And we ran, there was a group of us, we ran back to Aldershot railway station, and we, it wasn't till we got back on the train we felt sort of, what happened there, you know?
I have this visual in my mind.
So, yeah, so I was posted to Aldershot, and I wasn't really pleased because I wanted to do one of these exotic postings. But, no, it turned out to be the best posting in the world, you know, because in Aldershot, the British Airborne was there at the time. It was the parachute regiment. There was the three battalions and then 16 parachute brigade with, you know, all of the support units. There was all of the RCT. It was massive. Aldershot was huge with troops at the time.
Yeah, it was
And the PT school was just down the road from where I worked in the Royal Signals. I worked in HQ Southeast District Building, which was really just opposite, diagonal to Depot Browning Barracks Parade Square. So, so I was right in the thick of it, really.
So you were in the middle of this sea of maroon berets then?
Yeah, I called my book Marooned for that reason, because I was a female marooned in a sea of maroon, if you like. But I used to watch the guys jump in from the barrage balloon, which was there was a vehicle with a long cable on a coil, and it used to let the balloon, the barrage balloon, up. It was helium filled, and it used to go up to 800 feet and take four men up, and with a RAF dispatcher. And I used to lay underneath the barrage balloon watching all the men jump in from the barrage balloon. And I was right underneath the balloon. So they went from jumping out, and then they fell and fell and fell. And as they get closer, I could read the tread on the bottom of their shoes. And I thought, wow, I've got to have some of this.
Was it watching that kind of got you really interested in parachuting?
Yeah, well, I didn't know. I'd watched them parachuting, but I didn't know that free fall parachuting or sport parachuting existed. So
it's very different, though, isn't it? I know that, you know, Gary used to come home and talk about jumping out the balloon, and it's 800 feet is so different to the height of skydiving.
Well, yeah, I mean, to skydiving, you know, free fall, you. Basic static line, you go out, well, we used to go out at 2,000 feet. I think they've raised the altitude now. But no, 800 feet is very low, and totally different, because, you know, the military jumping is tactical. They use containers, you know, if they jump in with all the weapons and mortars and stuff like that, it's all the heavy equipment, whereas the sport parachuting, it's just you, your harness and your parachute, really. So, yeah, it's totally different.
So what happened then after you've watched the tread on these guys' feet, you know, and you've kind of lain there on the grass watching them? What happened with this interest? How did it move forward in terms of you actually doing it?
I went to the company office, which was in Duchess of Kent Barracks in Aldershot, and asked could I do a parachuting course. And I thought that the parachuting course was going to be what I'd just watched on Queen's Avenue, the men jumping out of the barrage balloon. And initially I was told that I couldn't do that because it was only for men. Well, that only was for men. And I think it still is only for men. I think there's only one female now that's passed P Company, but I'm not sure if she's even jumped to get her wings. But I was told initially I couldn't do it because it was the men only that could do it. But then I used to, you know, watch them. I used to also play Depot badminton. I used to play league badminton, and I was on the mixed doubles team down at Depot Para. I was on the mixed doubles team for about 2 years. And I got to know all of the blokes down at Depot. I mean, I entered the Army Championships playing badminton with Depot Para. The Army Championships were at Worthy Down at the time, which was the Royal Army Pay Corps depot. And I got to know all of the blokes, you know, there was officers there and sergeants and that. And they says, no, apply, when you go back up to your company office, apply to do a free-fall sport parachuting course. So I went back up to the office, you know, it took a few weeks. And they came up with a joint service parachute freefall course that was being run at Netherhaven, and they allowed four of us girls to go on it. We did all of our basic training in Depot Para Browning Barracks Gymnasium. Derek Thorne was the SSSI, was the senior PTI in depot at the time, and he did all the ground training. We did all our PLFs and packing our parachutes and emergency procedures, you know, how to get in the aeroplane, how to get out of the aeroplane, how to approach the aeroplane, because you don't walk, you know, anywhere near the propellers. And
not a good idea.
Some people have walked into the propellers, but you can't see them.
Yeah. Because
they're spinning round so fast. Yeah, I know a couple of people that have walked into propellers, and not very good outcome. But and then Derek arranged transport, Derek Thorne, and we came to Netherhaven in Wiltshire to the Joint Service Parachute Centre, and that was where I made my first parachute jump. I'd never even flown before. My first jump was my first flight.
What was it like to do that first jump?
Well, we'd done so much training. It's like going to the moon. I've never been to the moon, but I would imagine you train to go to the moon, but you don't actually know what it's like to go to the moon because you've never been there before. But we did all of the training. And then when we got to Netherhaven, you know, there was a few obstacles there because there was females. There was no female accommodation on the camp at Netherhaven. And things were so strict, and we weren't allowed to stay on the camp. We had to be accommodated at the nearby camp of Lark Hill, where there was a WRAC block, and then we had to be ferried back and forward because everything was catered for the blokes. There was no women allowed to stay there. But the night that we got to Netherhaven, we went over all of our procedures. You know, we did PLFs, parachute landing falls, and jumping off ramps, you know, forward, right, left, forward, right, left, and then we do back left and back right, and we did all our emergency procedures, and then we all went in the bar for a drink like you do at the parachute centre, and they called a manifest for the next day because I was with all of, you know, I'd done all my training with the junior parachute regiment, and they put me on the first lift. There was seven students and an instructor on each lift, and I was the first one out on the first lift. And I think the psychology was to put a female out first. I might have felt peer pressure that all the lads were looking at me, so I had to do it. And then there was peer pressure on the junior para lads that, you know, had seen me go out. And I suppose the psychology is, oh, blimey, she's gone out, I've got to go out, you know, because you do get people, refuse, you know, they refuse, and then they have to be brought back down again.
I tell you, I so admire you, Jackie, because I'm terrified of heights, and I've done one jump with the Red Devils back in the 90s, and I remember sat on that on the edge of the plane and thinking all the way, it was like, I can't do this, I can't do this, you know, it was like, so it's only when you actually come to do it that, you know, you realise you're actually jumping out into the air. But for those who don't know anything about parachuting, presumably at that stage you're on a static line and it's the beginning of your parachuting career.
The basic course was 15 jumps. The first few jumps were static line, and That's where you're hooked up with a line to the back of the parachute and to a strong point in the aircraft. And when you fall away, the line goes taut and it pulls the pack up. And we used to tie the end of the static line on with 100 pounds brake cord onto the top of the parachute. And obviously, once your body weight came to the end of the line, the brake cord snapped, and it was just left you with your parachute open, hopefully. And then your training had to come in about, you had to watch the wind. There's something called a wind cone. You've got to stay within the wind cone so that you land on the target area. So you just can't point your parachute anywhere. You've got to steer it to land in a reasonable sort of area on the drop zone. Otherwise, you know, there's trees and power lines and roads and things like that. But and then you do all of your training, initial training. You're training for your first jump in readiness for every jump, because there's no graduation to having a malfunction. So you have to know all of your emergency procedures right from the off, you know, what to do if you land in a tree, what to do if you land in power lines. There's no sort of graduation, like, oh, you've done five jumps now and you might get a malfunction, so we'll train you with all of your malfunction procedures. You know, you've got to be ready to go from the off, right from jump one all the way through. But then you do get experience from every jump that you do. And then after a few static line jumps, if you go out and you do a stable exit and you count, that you have to count 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, check canopy. And if you're stable, the instructor will put you onto a dummy pole and they'll put a dummy ripcord in your harness. You're still on static line where your parachute will be dragged out, but you have to prove that you can go in 1,000, 2,000. And we're on the 3,000, you go in and get the ripcord dummy pull and, you know, wave it to the instructor who was looking out the door of the aeroplane. And then if you did that three times consecutively, you went on to free fall. And then your first free fall was a 5 second delay. And that was scary, because you'd done these static line jumps where you knew that your parachute was going to open regardless. It didn't matter what position you were in when you went out. But then when you were put onto your first 5 second delay, you were suddenly aware that it was up to you. This was up to, you know, it was up to me to pull my ripcord, and I had to be in a stable position, face to earth, when I pulled the parachute, pulled the ripcord, so that the parachute didn't entangle and wrap around me if I was back to earth, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, totally. And on my one static jump that I've done, I have to say I got to 2,000 and then I screamed. So there was no three and four. And then the training, and I have to say the training was so good that at that point, after I'd screamed, I then kicked back into, oh, check canopy, and obviously you go from there. But you know, we'll come into that in a minute, because I could never understand until I actually did that jump, even though I was terrified of heights, what Gary used to always say to me, I can't explain it to you. You know, there's no way that I can explain to you that the high and the rush that I get from actually parachuting. You have to do it, and you have to experience it. And it is like that, isn't it? You go out, and even for somebody like me who was terrified of heights, my gosh, when I actually was floating down through the air, it was incredible. So can you just tell me, for you, what was your first jump? What did it feel like?
Well, my first jump was okay, because I'd done all this ground training, and it was like, you do everything and you're tested, you're asked questions and everything. So your training is complete, but you really don't know what your feelings, your emotions will be like with the adrenaline running around your body. The first jump was like going into unknown territory. I can tell you, when you get into the aeroplane, it's noisy. You've got we didn't have doors, in-flight doors on the aircraft. And it was a big Rapide, de Havilland Rapide aircraft with a big open door. So, you know, the wind was blowing around. There was somebody behind me being sick. You know, the smell of the sick was...
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, and so if you're feeling sick from the flight and then you've got this horrible, you know, smell of sick flying around as well, because he was, you know, he'd been sick on the front of his reserve. And then you climb out onto the wing of the aircraft when the instructor tells you to get out, and then when you let go, you watch the aeroplane fly away as you are falling away from the aircraft, and the instructor leans out of the door to watch your exit to see if you, because he gives you a critique when you land, you know, when you get back to the hangar, and then your parachute opens and you've gone from this really, really intense adrenaline flowing through your system, your ears pounding because your heart's beating in your ears, and then the noise of the engines, and then you're out in free fall, out in the slipstream, and your parachute opens and it's silence, totally silence. It's like you're in heaven. And then
that's the thing. That is actually the thing that I remember so vividly about it. And yes, and that's when I actually really got what Gary was talking about. And he, you know, when he was saying it, it's like another world. And it's like you're in this silence and you're in this environment, aren't you? And it's complete quiet and peace. Yeah. And that to me, suddenly I'd gone from being terrified of heights to thinking, wow, this is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, you say you're terrified of heights. Well, I am as well. I'm not very good with heights. I'm not very good with altitude either. Altitude sickness, I'm terrible with altitude sickness. But
it's interesting, isn't it? And yet you only get
vertigo when you're attached to the ground, you see. But when you're in an aeroplane, you're not attached to the ground, so you don't get vertigo. It's only when you're attached, like on a ladder or on the top of a cliff. But no, I'm not very good at heights either. You know, you'll get me on the edge of a cliff and I'm like 10 foot back. You wouldn't get me anywhere near. Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? But so how, when you've kind of describing this as heaven and this wonderful silence, was it then or was it afterwards that you decided that you wanted a lot more of this?
I decided I wanted to do it when I watched the blokes jumping out of the balloon. It was like, wow, I've got to have some of this, you know.
Yeah.
When I did my first jump, oh, wow. Before I'd done that, I was competitive in everything. You know, I used to swim for North Yorkshire, backstroke. I used to dive. When I joined the army, I was playing badminton, league badminton, and I used to play squash. I was always doing competitions and everything. But once I did that first jump, I couldn't wait to get back to the hangar to repack my parachute to go back up again. I was like full of it. When we all jumped on that first jump, you know, there were seven of us on the first lift, and we all landed on the airfield, and we sort of met halfway across the field, across the runway to go back to the hangar. And all you could hear was everybody talking about themselves. Everybody was full of themselves. And people, they didn't talk. They were shouting. It was like, did you see me? Did you see me? I was great, you know.
I can imagine.
But everybody was saying it. Did you see me? I was brilliant. It was brilliant, you know.
Does this include the guy that threw up on the plane?
Oh, yeah. I've seen so many people being sick in the aeroplane.
I can imagine. Yeah. I can. So
we always used to say, don't have breakfast before your first jump. And he obviously went down to the cookhouse and had a full English, didn't he? You know.
Sounds like it. So where did you go from this first course then? How did you actually get into the Red Devils?
Well, from the first course, I loved it. You know, I got onto free fall on my first course. And then I applied to go on the advanced course, which was about another 2 weeks later. from the basic course. And then I went on the advanced course, and obviously you advance, you go up to higher altitudes, and then your free fall is longer, and then you do turns and you do back somersaults, and you have to do certain things to progress. There's a license system in the sport. When you start off, you get your A license, and then you get your B license when you can do more maneuvers in the sky and land in a tighter area. On the ground, C license, you have to do a water jump and a night jump to qualify. And then the final license is a D license. And that you had to have over 200 jumps to get your D license. But I did the advanced course, so I was progressing. And then after that was the Army Championships. And I decided to enter the Army Championships. The Women's Royal Army Corps let me have, I'd had like extended time off work, you know, because I'd been on the basic course and then the advanced course. And then I wanted to do the Army Championships. And I entered the Army Championships into the novices event, and I won the novices event, and everybody, the cream of the sport, you know, in the military, it wasn't just the Army, the RAF was there, and the Navy, and I won the novices event at the Army Championships in 71, and Major Schofield, who was the team commander of the Red Devils was there, you know, and everybody looked up to them like they were sky gods, because, you know, they were all smart. They used to lay their gear out all smart, you know. It was you know, they look professional against, like, you know, me, the novice amateur. And after the prize giving, Major Schofield came up to me and he patted me on the back and he says, "Keep it up, girl, you've got talent." He said to me, "You could be world champion." And he sowed a seed, you know, because I'd got this trophy from General Mogg, who presented me with the Army Championships trophy, novices event. And I think Major Schofield, you know, planted a seed there that I was going to be world champion. And then after the Army Championships, I was approached. I kept on driving down to Netherhaven every weekend to do, you know, my jumps. That was my sport then. And and then Major Alex Black from 9 Squadron, he had a parachuting team called the Blue Eagles. And he asked me if I'd do a couple of demos, you know, parachute demonstrations for him in the summer. In the spring, well, it was May time. So we jumped into it. My first parachute demonstration was with 9 Squadron, and we jumped into Southwood Camp, which was the depot for Royal Engineers to do their basic training out of. And the first day I jumped out of a scout helicopter. We did two shows, and we jumped into the passing off parade in Southwood Camp.
Fabulous!
Yeah, we jumped once and then packed our parachutes on the side of the arena, got back into the helicopter, which was in the arena, and took off, and then jumped in again. And everybody was over me, because, like, I was a female, you know. It was like everybody was, there's a girl on the team, there's a girl. That's all you could hear. There's a woman, there's a girl on the team, you know. And everybody was, like, around me asking me, how did I get into parachuting? Because I think because Alex was a major and the others were sergeants and I was just a girl, I was more approachable, I think, to the young lads that were just joined the army and they were frightened of rank. And they were asking me, how did I get into parachuting? And the parents, you know, all of their families were. And it was like I'd done a one-woman parachute display, because everybody was around me. I'm not being big-headed. That's just how it was, because I was a novelty, I suppose, you know, a woman.
Well, you know, just to put this in perspective, Jackie, for people who are a little bit younger, who may be very inspired by your story, you know, it's a fantastic story. But just to put it into perspective, I know when we were talking about this chat, you know, you mentioned something about women, I know, were not allowed to do marathons at the time.
Well, I think back in the 70s, there was lots of things. I don't think I could have had a credit card in my name in the 70s. Or I think women weren't allowed. I was in the army when I was allowed to have a bank account with Lloyds, because all of the army had to go to Lloyds. Lloyds was the army bank.
Yeah.
Women in the army were non-combatants. They were not on the front line, and they were in the army as supportive roles. I don't think I could have taken the birth control pill at the time. Women couldn't wear trousers. Girls couldn't wear trousers to school. BBC.
Oh, I remember it well. I mean, there were many restrictions back.
Yeah, BBC television presenters, females, weren't allowed to wear trousers. There were so many restrictions. When I went to Netherhaven and there wasn't any female accommodation, that was the theme for quite a long time. Even when I joined the Red Devils, there wasn't any female accommodation, or there was nothing for women. There was no female toilets. When I joined the team, there was no ladies' toilet. I didn't mind. The lads used to stand outside and keep guard if I wanted to go in, to the toilet. But there was only a male toilet, because I was in the male barracks. There wasn't any female anything.
Well, it was a very male dominated world back in the early 70s. And I think the thing that I find great about the conversation, somebody said to me in an interview recently about women opening doors for men. And it's interesting, because what you've done is you've done both. You've opened up doors for other women to go into a very male-dominated sport. But also you're describing, a time when you've been doing this display and the other guys that are there are approaching you because you're more approachable than maybe the higher-ranking guys as well. Yeah. So they're asking you about how you got into it, and that's probably opened doors for them, and it's made them kind of want to do something. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, during that summer, I did a few donkey derbies and things like that for Alex, for 9 Squadron. And then Major Schofield asked me not to do any more parachute displays for the Royal Engineers, because he had something in line for me. But he wouldn't tell me what was in line for me, but it was obviously he was writing to my Queen Bee in the WRSC to try and get me released so that I could join the Red Devils full time. During the rest of 71, I joined the team. I was allowed to have Monday and Wednesday afternoon off from my WRSC job, which was still in the Royal Signals, because I never got to the PT school. And I used to go to Blackbush Airport with the team on a Monday and a Wednesday and jump with them. But on a weekend, I used to travel with them around the country and do DZ control. And I used to lay out the drop zone, and we had crowd control. Before you do a parachute display, you've got to do lots of preparation. You've got to get air clearance, you've got to have a notice to airmen so that nobody else flies in your airspace. You've got to get permission from the landowner, and you've got to have crowd control, insurance. You've got to let the police know. There's a lot of pre-planning before a parachute display. So I used to help with all of that. And then on a weekend, we'd drive around the country, and then I did the DZ for the blokes who were actually on the parachute team jumping into the arenas. And so I got to know all of the formats for the parachute displays. And the Red Devils were recruiting for the parachute regiment. And then because I was on the team, it was recruiting for the Women's Royal Army Corps as well. And because we were the forefront, we were like the window dressing for the army. And it just showed you what you could do if you joined the army or joined the parachute regiment. But and I joined.
You were a real poster girl back then.
I was quite lucky, actually. I mean, I was picked up by Helena Rubinstein. I don't know if you know. I used to go there regularly. Then they used to give me all these facials and everything. I used to go on photographic shoots. They took me to George Harrison's house from the Beatles once for a photographic shoot. And George was there. And I've got some fantastic pictures of, you know, me dressed up, which I never did when I was on the team. I was always in jumpsuit, tracksuit, T-shirt and jump boots.
And may I say you looked incredible in them too. You know, you were an abs. I mean, you're a good-looking woman now, but you were an absolute babe back then. So, I mean, I just imagine you on all these shoots doing.
Oh yeah,
I've seen some incredible photos of you, Jackie.
Wherever I went, the press were after me. You know, I had to pause with the children because we, during the summer months, we used to do parachute displays all over the country. I think I've jumped into every field in the country, like donkey derbies, Grand National, flower shows, there's agricultural shows in, you know, Harrogate and Scottish Highland shows, jumped at the Isle of Wight, TT races, Isle of Man. And then during the winter months, and it was all recruiting, you know, we were keeping the army in the public eye. And during the winter months, we used to do static parachute displays. We used to go to universities and colleges and schools. It was all recruiting. And we used to demonstrate all of the parachuting equipment on the stage. We used to get crowd involvement. We always used to get somebody out, you know, from the audience to try the equipment on. And then we'd let them pull the ripcord. And then we'd show them the deployment of the parachute, how it worked. And then they'd have questions and how, you know, how do you breathe in free fall, or how do you keep going when your rocket stops? Because we used to wear smoke on our feet, and I think a lot of the kids used to think they were rockets, like Buzz
Lightyear. They were propelling you along.
I tell you what, I wish I had a pound for every time I'd been asked, how do you keep going when your rocket stops?
Oh, and, bless.
Yeah, and then the press used to come to all of the schools. Everywhere we went, we used to schedule the press to come with us, you know, to meet us there. And then they'd do a photo shoot with the local children and with the parachutes on, or, you know. And, yeah, so that's what we were very busy, you know. We used to do, I did 6 weeks solid driving around the country with Bob Harmon. We used to go off in teams of two in the winter, and we'd just go and do two lecture demonstrations a day and then move on to the next town and do two more the next day. Most of it was arranged by, we used to have HQ Southeast District or HQ Northwest District, HQ Northeast District, and they all used to organise these demonstrations and then send us our agenda, and then we just got in the team vehicle and just went off. And
So how long were you doing all of this? Because in effect, when you're still with the Royal Signals and you're still actually a WRAC on the one hand and you started doing this on the other, how long were you actually doing that whole 7 day a week thing? Because it sounds like you had absolutely no free time in the early days. How long did that continue for?
I was part-time on the team in 1971, but in February 1972, I was allowed to join the Red Devils full-time, as a full-time, fully-fledged member. So my WRAC job didn't exist for me anymore. I was full-time on the Red Devils. And so, and it was just full-on. We didn't get leave during the year. We used to get block leave. We used to get 3 or 4 weeks off at Christmas time. We all used to go across to America and spend all our money on parachuting in America because the weather was nice. But now during the season, if you like, the summer season, which was from February right through, because we used to jump into passing off parades at Depot Para every month or so, whenever it was. We had military obligations as well. We used to jump into all of the army shows around the country. And then the rest of the shows were like the Grand National and things like that. We used to jump all the time, all week. We used to get Mondays off if it wasn't a bank holiday. And Monday was the only day that we had off to do our own personal admin, like, you know, jumpsuits had to be washed, and we had to polish our boots and clean the helmets, and we had to modify our equipment and repair it if we'd had tears in the equipment and things like that. You know, it was very busy. You know, we only get one day off a week if we were lucky. And then through the winter months, when we were doing the lecture demonstration, that was full on as well. And then we only got 4 weeks off at Christmas. So it wasn't just, you know, 7 days a week for a certain period of time. It was 7 days a week for 11 months. And then we'd get 3 or 4 weeks off at Christmas time, which was, and then we'd be back in the office, back in the team room again on the 5th of January after having like December off. But we were on a busman's holiday. We loved it. We were parachuting. We were skydiving. You know, it was long hours. It was very long hours, long journeys. We did like 5 or 6 parachute displays in a day. And we might have had, say, Manchester Army show at 10 o'clock in the morning, but they also wanted us to jump in at 7 o'clock in the evening. But in between those times, we might have had the Southport Flower Show and the Grand National. We might have had another show up in Scotland. And there was 3 demonstration teams on the Red Devils. So on a Saturday, we had 3 full teams flying around the country, jumping into also Congleton Carnival, the Harrogate, Great Yorkshire Show. And we didn't have enough people on the team. We used to have to get guest jumpers in from other airborne units that were freefall parachutists, you know, from like REME, RCTs, anybody that was in 16 Parachute Brigade, really, that wore a maroon beret, they used to come and make up the team. We had a red team, a black team, and a competition team. I was on the competition team, but we also did demonstrations when we weren't competing, because most of my time was, you know, competing for the team at the Army Championships, National Championships. And
what was it like for you when you got your maroon beret?
I'd been on the team for 2.5 years, and they had a committee meeting at Depot Para. I was reading about this the other day, and all of the generals and the colonels got together and decided that because I'd been such an ambassador for the team, that they were going to award me the maroon beret. And I was presented with the beret. You know, this went through long talks, discussions with the senior parachute regiment soldiers, you know, officers and hierarchy. And, General Sir Windy Gale, he was a Normandy veteran. We jumped into the, in front of the Dakota outside Browning Barracks, and landed in front of the Dakota, and he put the maroon beret on my head and took my green one off, you know, my WRAC one, and put the maroon one on it. It was massive. It was a massive press day. The TV was there. There was international press, and, you know, I was the first female in the world to wear the maroon beret. And I think, oh, blimey, there was hundreds of people there. It was just a massive press day. And so that was really good, because it was, you know, again, it was press for the Army, for the Parachute Regiment. And
but what was it like for you getting that put on your head?
How proud, you know. I mean,
yeah.
Amazing. I mean, what a privilege. It really was a privilege to be able to wear it. Obviously, I didn't do my military parachute training. I wasn't allowed because I was a female, but that's another story. I wasn't even allowed to fly in military RAF aircraft back then. because I was female. But no, I was very proud. It was a very proud moment for me. I felt about 60 foot tall when I walked out away from that arena. You know, I landed at 5'4" and I walked out of the arena at 6'8". You know,
I can imagine, Jackie, because it's so coveted, that maroon beret, isn't it? And the guys go through absolute hell to get it. But in your own way, in a very different way, you've gone through your own kind of hell, because it may have been something that you really wanted to do, but I don't think many people, unless they were sort of around in those early 70s years, kind of get how hard it was for women. And you really, really opened doors doing what you did.
Yeah, well, I wanted to go and get a light bulb. The men get their wings to wear, you know, on their shoulder after they've done their military parachute jumps. And there is a light bulb for people that there used to be a light bulb. I don't know if they still do it now, for anybody that jumped that wasn't airborne. And the team sent me, well, it was going to be a big military PR event between the Army, the Women's Royal Army Corps, and the Parachute Regiment and the RAF. And I went to Abingdon to do my jumps. I was going to do them clean fatigue. You know, I wasn't going to get my wings out of this. I was going to just do my jumps because I was wearing a maroon beret, but I hadn't done any military parachuting. And I was there for about 4 or 5 days doing ground training, synthetic training, you know, the military parachute regiment and paratroopers do. And then I was called up to the office, and I think it was a Wing Commander Smith called me into the office, and he said, he was really apologetic, and he said that the hierarchy in the RAF wouldn't allow me to jump out of a C-130 because I was female, for one, and there was no female toilet. That was the only thing that they could come up. There was no female toilet on a military C-130. I'd already done about 120 jumps out of a C-130 because I'd been training in America with the Golden Knights, the Army Parachute Team from America, the United States Army Parachute Team. And I'd been out there the previous November. And
did they have toilets?
Well, no, I've never seen an aircraft in a toilet in a jump aircraft.
I mean, toilets for women in general. Did they have facilities?
They have a rose bowl for men to wee into, don't they? I think. But I think with military, I've never seen a man go to the toilet in an aircraft. But no, that was the only excuse that they could come up with. So, yeah, so I came back to Aldershot, and I wasn't allowed to jump the C-130. But even when I was on the team, if, say, we were jumping into the Aldershot Army Show and it was into Queen's Avenue or Rushmore Arena, sometimes the team used to get a C-130 because some of the Air Force used to jump in with us. And I used to have to just blend in with the crowd and not be seen as a female. And the lads would walk around me and would go onto the C-130, and nobody knew that I was a girl on the team jumping. And I jumped quite a few times into Aldershot Army shows out of the C-130, but I really wasn't allowed to have even been on the C-130 because I was a female.
Just so it's, I mean, I remember it because I'm a little bit younger than you, but I was kind of, you know, very much around in that sort of era of having to wear a skirt to work and all that kind of thing. And, you know, these days, I don't think young girls and young women can understand how hard it was back then for women to be able to do the stuff.
I think even with, like, now the maroon beret, if you went to Colchester, Every female that's attached to the parachute regiment wears a maroon beret, and there's no hoo-ha, there's no, you know, big issue about it. They're attached to the parachute regiment, and they all wear the maroon beret. There's, if you went to Colchester, you know, you'd be, I think you'd be very surprised to see how many now are you know, women are wearing the maroon beret. But it was such an honour and such a privilege to be the first, and to be able to, I was very proud indeed.
And so you should be. It's an incredible journey that you've had. So tell me, I know you mentioned to me that you jumped into Hungary in 1974. Tell me about that, because that was behind the Iron Curtain then, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was national champion in 74, and there was three or four other Red Devils on the British team. We did really well at the Army Championships and the National Championships. There was Scotty Milne, Dee Crite, I can't remember who else was there. Dan Kenny was there. He was two para. And we made the British team, and the World Championships was in Hungary, a place called Zolonok. And because we were military, we had to get special permission, dispensation from the military to go, because it was behind the Iron Curtain. You know, there was a lot of spying going on. And we got permission, and we went to this drop zone in Zolonok. And everywhere we went, we were supervised. We were escorted everywhere. Even when we got into the vehicle back to the accommodation back in the evening, we were escorted by two like police cars. That there was military and everything, and very very strict it was, very very strict. And it was an experience going into a communist country, just seeing, you know, how far behind they were from the West. But it wasn't too much longer that they, you know, the walls came down, didn't they, in Berlin and everything. But
we were posted. I mean, Tupara had their, I think it was their first posting in abroad in 18 years, because they were more often than not in Aldershot. And I got married in 1977, so I was there for most of their posting, 77 to 79 in Berlin. And although West Berlin was kind of where it was, people don't realise that back then you were still nevertheless behind the Iron Curtain, so you had to fly through the corridor to get there, you know, and you had to fly sort of at that 2,000 feet level, and the plane would be juddering, you know, and it was not very pleasant at all. And you had to have an ID card, you know, wherever you went, you had to carry your ID card. So it was a different world back then.
It was, yeah. And being female as well, when we got to Hungary, it was like there was this segregation. There was no, women were allowed to sleep near men. I mean, for goodness sake, what would they get up to? Women were accommodated miles away from where the blokes were. It happened with me a lot when I was on, the first time I went to America, in 1972 with the team. We went to train with the United States Army Parachute Team in Fort Bragg for the Golden Knights. And, there was no other females on Fort Bragg. You know, there I was. I was wearing my WRAC beret at the time, which was green. And everybody there thought that I was the only airborne one, because, they all thought I was the because the airborne wore green berets there.
Yeah, it's the green beret, isn't it?
So I was the only one wearing a green beret. When we got to the place in Fort Bragg, I couldn't stay anywhere in the accommodation where my team were that I lived with 24 hours a day. They put me up in an accommodation that was 3 miles away in the bachelor officers' quarters. But during the day, if I was back at the Golden Knights team area, there was no female toilets. And I don't know if it's the same in America now, but when you go to the bathrooms in America, in American camps, this was all male camps. There was no female accommodation. And there was like a massive room with like 28 toilets in it with no cubicles. I don't know if you've ever seen them. They're just toilets, a row of toilets on the left and a row of toilets on the right. So there was no, so if I wanted to go to the toilet, the lads used to have to stand outside the door and keep everybody out just so that I could go in and have a wee. There was no female. So I used to stay in the bachelor officers' quarters, which is about 3 miles away. And I used to walk to the team room in the morning. Some mornings they used to send a vehicle out for me, but it was just beautiful to be able to walk it. You know, in North Carolina, it's gorgeous with all of the pine trees, and I could connect with nature before I got to go out parachuting.
Incredible, incredible. It's just such a story, yours. Where's your favourite out of all of those years that you were parachuting? Where would you say that your favourite place to jump was?
Well, I've been in the sport, you know, jumping for like 50 years tomorrow. I've jumped all over. The favourite place... I jumped off El Capitan in Yosemite National Park once. It was classed as a base jump. It's when you jump out off a rigid, you know, object rather than an aeroplane.
Yeah.
And Yosemite National Park is just the most beautiful place on earth. I took my son there 4 years ago just to go back and do some hiking, and it's like you've died and gone to heaven at Yosemite National Park. But yeah, I jumped off El Capitan, and that was amazing experience. The rock face is a sheer rock face. It's 3,200 feet above the ground, but we had to take about 6.5 hours to hike up there with all our parachutes. And we jumped off at last light, you know, as the sun was setting. It was just the most incredible feeling. You've got this element of fear because you've never jumped off a rock before. And I felt like a bank robber when my parachute opened.
I love it.
When you breathe in the top of your chest and it's like,
yeah.
You can't take enough air in, and I could feel my body like trembling because of the adrenaline that was racing through. It was, but then you had to be very good at flying your parachute to be able to land in a small area, you know, and I've done lots of accuracy jumps. And because when you get down to the lower level, the trees are like 400 foot tall, and there's not many places to land when you get below the tree level. And then when you get below the tree level, if there's any wind, the wind drops off, and then your parachute surges forward faster than you anticipated. And, you know, there's lots of obstacles like trees, and there was a river, fast flowing river and everything. But, oh no, it was just amazing. I jumped onto Copacabana Beach in Brazil. That was lovely, flying around in the Brazilian aircraft. We did a demonstration for, you know, with the Brazilian army. And
when was that?
We went out to Brazil in 1973. We'd been invited out to an international air show, and flew out to Recife, and then we went to a place called we stayed in Sao Paulo, which was, I think, the fifth largest city in the world at the time. Amazing city. And we drove every day out to a place called San Jose dos Campos, which was a military airfield. I was the first female parachutist to be seen in Brazil. And I was also the first female soldier. I think they'd just come out of like a dictatorship in Brazil with the old guerrillas. And so, again, all of the press were all over me, TV and everything. And we jumped into this air show every day, twice a day, with the Brazilian army and the American army parachute team, the Golden Knights. we jumped twice a day into this big air show, and there was, you know, all the British, there was a Nimrod there, and there was biplanes and glider pilots doing all of the shows and everything. And then after that, we were invited up to Rio de Janeiro by the British consulate, and we were asked to jump into the football stadium in Rio de Janeiro. I can't think what the stadium's called. It'll come to me. And but it was too windy on the day we were supposed to jump into this football stadium, the Maracana Stadium. And it would have been crazy with all of the crazy Brazilians and everything. But then on the day that we were leaving Brazil, you know, we were flying out late in the evening, we'd been asked to jump onto the beach at Copacabana Beach. And that was just outrageously scariest jump I've ever been on. We had an arena set out on the sand, if you like, and between the sand and the hotels on the other side of the road, it was a 4-lane road system. And when I got out of the aeroplane on the first pass, we were jumping the Hawker Siddeley 748, a big aeroplane, and I got out of the aeroplane on the first pass with, I think it was Joe Gregg, and I could see the arena, but as I was getting lower and lower, the arena just disappeared because all of the crowd just ran into the arena. There was nowhere to land. It was just bodies. The yellow sand went black, you know, because everybody had dark hair, and it was just a beach of blackness. That's all I can say it was. And I landed on somebody's back, and I had a smoke bracket on my foot. You know, when you wear a smoke bracket, it gets really hot. And I bounced off this bloke's back and landed. But then they were trying to pick me up and take me away as a souvenir. They were crazy. They were chanting. That was the scariest I've ever been. And that
wasn't very good crowd control with that one, then, was there?
Well, you couldn't control them at all. Normally, you'd put a fence around it, but there was just no crowd control at all. We did have the airborne unit that was supposed to be like our guards, and then they came out and they started shooting their guns in the air to disperse all of these people, because there was other parachutists coming into land behind me.
Yeah.
And they were trying to steal like my berry and the ripcord and stuff like that, and then this armed guard escorted me across the road through this crazy crowd, absolutely crazy crowd, and they got me into this hotel, and I went up to the next floor where they had like a balcony, and I could watch them. I've got photographs of all of the people, and we couldn't, when the rest of the team landed and got into the hotel, it was like they were chanting, they were breaking windows, they were tipping cars over. We couldn't get out of this hotel for about 6 or 7 hours, and in the end they had to send a stretch limo, and we got into the back of this limo. I think there was two limos, and they took us to the airport in Rio de Janeiro, and it was there where we could lay all our gear out and see what had been stolen. You know, Steve Slater had his maroon berry stolen, and there was rip cords, there was smoke brackets, there was parachutes stolen. Oh yeah, I've never been scared in all my life. But yeah, if it hadn't have been for the airborne guards that was escorting us, I don't know what would have happened. You know, it was just surreal, just amazing.
It sounds very scary. It really does. Yeah. But you know, the view that we have usually of the sort of displays that the Red Devils would do, exactly what you're describing. There would be a very small area for sure that you would have to land into.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be in that situation of certainly having to land on the back of somebody on a crowded beach. I mean, that...
It's all nice to come back and just land into like a Vickers tea party at the Bath, you know, Bath Hotel, and where everybody was like civilised. And
slight difference. So the thing that's striking me as we're going on with this conversation is that, you know, you started off life joining the WRAC and were sort of not that impressed with getting sent to Aldershot instead of, you know, like these fantastic postings that, that other people were getting abroad at the time. And yet your travels, you know, the way it's almost like the way fate took you down a different path, it's opened up, you know, into this completely different journey to being the PTI that you had set out to be. And you sound like you've actually done so much more traveling than you would have done if you had got one of those postings.
I'm just so glad I wasn't 17 and 11 months. Otherwise, I might have got one of those exact
Exactly. And that's, you know, that's the interesting thing about fate. You know, it's the way that things unfold in front of us, isn't it? And the things that spark our interest and the things that we end up doing. Now, you've got quite a few awards that you've won over the years you've been parachuting. So can you tell us something about them?
Yeah, well, I've been on British teams. I 74 was my first British team. I went to Hungary with the British team, and then I was national champion in 75. But world championships are not every year. And 76, I was on the British team again. Went to Wadonia in Italy with a British team. 77, I was on the British team. Went to Australia. 78, I went to the World Championships in Zagreb in Yugoslavia, formerly Yugoslavia, and that's where I won the World Championships. 1979, I was on the British team again. Won a silver medal. 1981, I was on the British team in Zephyr Hills in Florida. And then because of all of my achievements, I've won the Royal Aero Club Award of Great Britain, which was the gold. So I'm in the company of like Blériot and the Wright brothers. It's just amazing the people who've won this award before me. I've won the Prince of Wales Cup. And then I was inducted into the Skydiving Hall of Fame, the International Skydiving Hall of Fame, in 2013. And then in 2017, I won the Jim Crocker Sword, which is the highest award that the British Parachute Association award anybody for all of my achievements. And then just recently I've been made an ambassador of the International Skydiving Museum and Hall of Fame. And yeah, I think I've won a couple of other little things as well. I've got so many, can't remember.
It's an incredible career that you've had skydiving. Yeah, it really is.
And that's all because I went and did that very first jump. Took myself out of my comfort zone and did something. Everything I've done has been out of my comfort zone. You know, joining the army. I came from a council estate up north. Yeah. I didn't know anybody in the army. I didn't know anything about military life. And so for me to go from where I was to even join the army, and then for me to go on the parachuting course and do that jump, I'd never even flown before. My first jump was my first flight as well. Even when I jumped off El Capitan, that was out of my comfort zone, you know. And they turned out to be just the most incredible things that ever happened to me. And then it was like being on a stone. It just rolled and rolled and rolled. And the further I went, the further I rolled, the more I experienced and the more I did. I didn't plan all this. It just happened. I just woke up in a dream.
Well, it's interesting that you say about doing things out of your comfort zone, because it's nowhere near on the same scale of the career that you've had. But when I got into bodybuilding, it again was something that was kind of women, very, very few women actually did bodybuilding back in the days when I started. And it certainly was not in my comfort zone to get on the stage in a bikini flexing my muscles, you know. So, you know, I was so nervous the first show I ever did. And, you know, it was like, really? And it was because somebody in the gym had sort of just said to me one day, hang on a minute, do a back double biceps. And because I couldn't see my back, so they just went, geez, you know, like, wow, you should compete. And I'm like, should I? Can't see my back. Like, what's it look like? You know what I mean? And then, you know, it was sort of that, again, it plants a seed, doesn't it? You sort of think, yeah, again, outside of your comfort zone. Yeah. And then you kind of end up doing things and going through. And I don't think people realize, though, in the date that we're in now in 2021, how hard things were for women back then and how frowned upon it was to do certain things. So, you know, the thing that impresses me about your story is how much you've done that has been outside your comfort zone, but also where people did encourage you and people seem to want you to actually do well, you know, in that initial encouraging you to go for it, you know?
Well, you know, when I first started parachuting, the equipment for one was all military surplus equipment. There was no like sport equipment that they've got nowadays, which is all lightweight and padded harness. Mm. And so all of the equipment that I was using right from the start, even for like the first 5 years, was heavy. It was there was no padding on the harness. It used to bruise me. I was covered in bruises all the time. Yeah. You know, because when your parachute opens after free falling at 120 miles an hour, and you suddenly come to a stop, it's the harness that sort of digs into your body. You know, your leg straps and your chest straps. Your arms and everything. So I was covered in bruises. The equipment was heavy. I think it used to weigh about 40 pounds. That was a big deterrent to females in the sport anyway. Yeah. And if there was any females took up or even did parachute, they gave it up because there was nothing feminine about it. It was heavy gear. It was hard work carrying it. It was hard work packing the parachutes. But I loved it. I just loved the lifestyle. I loved the rough and tumble. Never complained. I never, you know, when I joined the team, I joined as a team member. I didn't want to be classed as a female and get special treatment because I couldn't do things. Obviously, if I got stuck, I used to ask the lads to help me. But I never ever whinged because I was a female and I couldn't do things. You know, I'm not a feminist. I think a lot of men have been beat up. It wasn't the men that were holding me back. It was institutions at the time.
I totally get that, Jackie. I totally get that because being in the world of bodybuilding, and it really was, you could be the only woman in a complete sea of men.
Yeah.
Back in those days, and you know, there was no kind of problem with you doing the training, but it was society that frowned on you. You know, it wasn't the guys. The guys were very welcoming.
I had all of the most, you know, incredible encouragement from all of the blokes around me. Major Schofield, you know, I mean, he opened the door for me, you know, to get onto the team, and the parachute regiment allowed me in, you know, thankfully. And all the time that I was on the team, you know, I was jumping with the cream of the crop. And when you train with the best, they lift you up to their standard if you have the attitude and, I suppose, ability to get there as well. I never, ever complained. I never whinged, you know, that I was a female and I couldn't do it. I did struggle, but I got on with it. I got on with the struggle and just did it. And I think because I was so good at accuracy, you know, I used to help the other team members, and it went both ways.
Now tell me about this accuracy, because this kind of thing that I read about you, where you actually scored a perfect.
When you do accuracy, just in parachute, in sport parachuting, there's different events. Like if you go on a four-way team, it's four people and you go up to 11,000 feet and you've got to do different formations in the sky, and in the 40 seconds that you've got to work before you pull your ripcord, if you like, we don't use ripcords anymore, but you know, to the general public think that you do, but and you score different points for every formation. They're all predetermined for each skydive, for each competition, and you score points in those, you know, 35 or 40 seconds working time. And whoever's got the most points, obviously, is the winner. And then you've got accuracy, where your parachute opens, you've got to land on a electronic marking device. And the electronic target for me was a 10-centimetre disc, if you like. It was like a cushion, which was about 16 centimetres in diameter, but then in the centre of it was the 10 centimetre target. And so when you land on the pad, the electronic pad, if you land right in the centre of it, it will measure 0.00 centimetres. And obviously if your foot is slightly off the centre, it will measure electronically up to 16 centimetres. So, you know, you might get 5 centimetres on the first jump and 10 centimetres on the second jump and 2 centimetres the third jump and a 0.00. And over the competition, which was the World Championships that I went to, whoever's got the least amount of centimetres is obviously the most accurate. And at the World Championships in Zagreb in Yugoslavia, I scored 10 0.00s back to back, and I was the first person in the world, male or female, to score zero over 10 jumps. American girl was behind me with a total of 2 centimetres after 10 jumps. And then there was a Russian girl, had a total of 3 centimetres after 10 jumps. So there was no room for error. And it was the first time Great Britain had ever won a gold medal in parachuting. So,
incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Just can't tell you what it felt like. It was just amazing. I mean, the pressure was immense between my 9th jump and my 10th jump. There was a couple of days where it was bad weather. When you're doing accuracy, you've got to land into wind. You jump a square parachute and you land facing into wind. And like an aeroplane does a landing, you know, it comes downwind, across wind, and then into wind. And it's not constant. Sometimes it's light, and then the next second it's gusts. And then you get thermals, and the windsock sort of goes around in 360s and everything.
It's very unpredictable, isn't it? That's what makes what you achieve so incredible to me. It's
okay learning how to fly a parachute, but you've got to learn to fly it and take into consideration all of the elements. Like if there's a weather front coming in, there's always stronger winds come in. Sometimes there's no wind at all after a storm or before a storm, when the air is really thick and moist, humid, and your parachute doesn't move forward because it's so dense. Whereas on a hot day, the air is thinner, you know, and you have to take all of these things into contention when you are training. And and it all came together for the World Championships. I peaked at the right time. I'd been training in North Carolina for about 6 weeks before the World Championships, and it was all coming together. And I knew when I got to the World Championships, I know this sounds a bit big-headed, I did you're allowed to do a practice jump first. Everybody does a practice jump just to get visuals of the airfield so that you can see, you know, what the airfield looks like and jump the aircraft that you're jumping out of. And I did my practice jump and I got a dead center. I got 0.00. And I walked back to the British team tent and I saw the Union flag flying. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to win this. This is mine. I'm going to win this. I told myself, this is mine. I'm going to win this. And there I did. I blooming well won it, didn't I?
Well, that's what we call goal setting and achievement. So what would you, I mean, your story is incredible. It really is. It's been such a pleasure and a privilege to have this conversation today. But as we're kind of drawing to a close now, what would you say to young girls and young women today? What bit of advice would you give them in terms of going after what they want in life?
Just go for it. I mean, I think nowadays it's different, isn't it? The training now is so much easier, that, you know, like for everything, for anybody, male or female. But if anybody wants to, I think you've got to have the drive to want to be what you want to be, whether it's just somebody that's good at computer games or somebody that's good at badminton. But I set myself, the first time I won a trophy was at the Army Championships when I was, I'd just come out of my second course, my advanced parachute course, and I won the Army Championships. And when I won that trophy, I wanted to be world champion after Major Schofield told me I could be world champion, because I thought he was so high profile, and so he was a sky god in my eyes. And just the fact that he told me that I could be world champion, just the fact that he even spoke to me, I was gobsmacked that he even spoke to me, let alone told me I could be world champion. And then he sowed that seed. So I think surround yourself with positive people in whatever you want to do. And like-minded people, and people that want to be on the same path as you. And yeah, keep going at it. Just and don't, if defeat is a learning game. I didn't always win. If I lost something, I learned from it. It was always a lesson. Winning isn't always the best. It's nice to win, but sometimes it's good to lose to learn where you went wrong and what you have to do to be your best.
Yeah, I totally agree with that one. Yeah. And before we wind up today, Jackie, can we finish off with just talking about your book, Marooned? Because I think that's a brilliant title. Is it still on sale?
Yeah, I've got some books here. I could give you my email address, but it's also on Amazon. You could buy it on Kindle as well. It's Marooned by Jackie Smith. I called it Marooned because I wore the maroon beret. I was surrounded by the maroon machine, and I was a female marooned in this all-male environment. So, yeah, I had a couple of names lined up, you know. I was going to call it The Devil in Me, but I thought, no.
I love it.
But then the people might take that the wrong way, you know, I can see.
Well, they might do. They might do.
Yeah.
No, I totally. I called it Marooned. Yeah, I totally think you got the title spot on with that one. I think, you know, it's the play on words, you know, you were marooned in this sea of men, but also you were wearing the maroon beret, I think is a brilliant title. So what we'll do is when this goes on YouTube, we'll put a link underneath it so that people can find your book. Yeah. And it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today. I could talk to you for hours. You've got so much, just so many adventures and experiences to share. You really have. And wish you all the best with being an ambassador for the future. I'm sure we have not heard the last of Jackie Smith.
Oh, thank you very much, Jay. It's been a pleasure.
That concludes episode 10 of Alternate Realities. I really hope you enjoyed the interview. I certainly enjoyed making it, although I do like to call these episodes conversations. And it was certainly a great one to have with Jackie. So much fun. So amazing to listen to all that she has done with her life. Something stuck out to me at the end, though, and I guess I always put my therapist head on at these moments. She said something about they lift you up to their level. And I'd like to end on this. In psychology, we have something called leveling. And when people are insecure and they look at you and they feel less than, what tends to happen is instead of aspiring to be like you, they will try and bring you down to their level to make them feel more secure within themselves. That's what leveling is. It's really important that when you're starting out in life and when you're seeking to achieve your goals, to follow your dreams, that you don't let people bring you down. Jackie, by a set of circumstances, just by when her birthday was, ended up not going where she wanted to go initially, and it took her down a completely different path because she decided she wanted to do one thing, and that was to parachute. And that began to open doors. She was put in the pathway of people that wanted to lift her up, and lift her up they did. And she went with them and she rose to great heights. There is a lot to be gained from listening to this interview and for understanding that when we don't give up on our dreams, when we hold them in a place where they're dear to our heart, when we set small goals, we achieve. And when we keep achieving small goals, we eventually end up achieving our larger goals. So always look to surround yourself as much as you can with people that really want you to succeed in life. Take care until next time.